This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And there are multiple events regarding human rights in Libya unfolding even as we speak. Overnight, human rights official Navi Pillay at the United Nations addressed the Security Council on the continuing detentions and tortures and non-judicial treatment of prisoners and stated explicitly that there was an element of racial discrimination in the operations of the militias and other institutions inside Libya today. And the global human rights organization Amnesty International released a major report called Libya, Deaths of Detainees and Widespread Torture. The opening paragraph of that reads as follows. Several detainees have died after being subjected to torture in Libya in recent weeks and months amid widespread torture and ill treatment of suspected pro-al-Qaddafi fighters and loyalists. Delegates have met detainees who showed visible marks indicating torture inflicted in recent days and weeks. Their injuries included open wounds on the chest, limbs, back, and other parts of the body. We are now joined live by Sanjeev Berry, Amnesty International's Advocacy Director for Middle East and North Africa. Welcome, Sanjeev. This is quite a stunning report. What are the major points of it?
Well, thank you for having me on the show. Amnesty International definitely appreciates the opportunity to share these very challenging and brutal facts that have been derived from our mission in Libya. The broad outlines are that we still have a situation in Libya in which potentially very large numbers of people are being held in a diverse patchwork of detention centers controlled by local militias, and that many may be subjected to torture and repeated acts of torture and brutality as part of their ongoing detention. It's a broad challenge that has emerged in the aftermath of the decades under Qaddafi's repressive rule, that now you have this chaotic environment where you have so many different detention centers and militias that are conducting torture and grabbing people off the streets in some cases, targeting people based on alleged loyalties to Qaddafi, based on skin color in some cases, and subjecting them to quite cruel punishments.
The report says that detainees, both Libyan and foreign nationals from sub-Saharan African countries, told Amnesty that they had been suspended in contorted positions, beaten for hours with whips, cables, plastic hoses, metal chains, and bars and wooden sticks, and given electric shocks with live wires and taser-like electroshock weapons. What do we know about the demographics of those who are being subjected to this as far as has been able to be determined? I'm hearing many reports that there is a racial element and that people who are of apparent African aspect are particularly vulnerable to these activities, even if they are Afro-Libyans and citizens of Libya.
That is indeed accurate. There has were during the Libyan conflict widely overly exaggerated rumors that Qaddafi had hired a large number of mercenaries from outside of Libya or darker skinned Libyans or sub-Saharan Africans in his conflict with rebel forces. And that wildly exaggerated rumor has intersected with pre-existing racism and xenophobia to make many darker-skinned Libyans, as well as black Africans, sub-Saharan Africans, whatever the terminology is that one wants to use, the subject of these sorts of abductions, of torture, of unfair detention that never ends, in which the detainees don't have the opportunity to talk to a lawyer, to find out why they are detained, or in some cases, to see the light of day.
Have you learned anything about the geographic distribution of these abuses? There being tripartite cultural division in what was once a unified nation of Libya, with the Cyrenaicans to the east, the Tripolitanians to the west, and the more Afrogenetic part of the country in the south. Is there any kind of geographic pattern that is evident yet?
Well, one of the challenges with this situation is that precisely because there isn't a centralized authority that is exerting its will and sending a clear message to these diverse militias and detention centers, the result of that is it is difficult to have hard and specific numbers with regards to geographic distribution, with regards to the ethnicity or demographics of the people who are being held. There are certainly signs that people who are affiliated with tribes that were considered to be, quote-unquote, more loyal to Gaddafi or in the regions where Gaddafi's troops were, are being subjected to discriminatory practices, torture, and in some cases even in-custody deaths. But the big problem is that because it's such a chaotic environment and because the NTC, the new government authorities in Libya, are not doing enough to centralize the control of the detention centers, it's difficult to answer the question you just asked.
One of the hotspots of which we are aware is in the area near Sirte, Tripoli, Misrata and Dawarga, which was largely black enclave, a remnant of the slave trading days when that was a staging ground for that activity. And the militias from there apparently caused to disappear or caused to flee some tens of thousands of people who are facing all kinds of racist slogans and death threats and impromptu lynchings. And the militia in that region has said that the town of Dawarga will not ever live again, that it will be called the new Misrata. Do you suspect that possibly racism and violence is being used for the annexing of land?
You know, we don't have a definitive statement to make on that. I mean, it's clear that racism and violence are definitely intersecting and are definitely at play. As to what the specific motives are of specific militia leaders in different local areas, it's difficult to say what the motives might be, whether it's a question of maintaining power or using that power to acquire assets or resources. That's not part of this current report with that kind of granular detail. Broadly speaking, it's safe to say that in an environment where there is not accountability, you are going to have all kinds of political actors using force, using the barrel of a gun to exert their local will. And that's why in an environment of impunity, which is the environment that many Libyans find themselves living in right now, authorities and localized power figures are able to do what they want. That's why we're having these allegations of torture emerge. That's why we're having situations where Amnesty International researchers who have been on mission in Libya are meeting people who are literally showing them their open wounds, in some cases hours after having been tortured. In other cases, Amnesty International is having interactions or has had interactions with Libyans who are afraid to speak for fear of additional torture, but will simply show them where on their body the torture happened. These kinds of things are all a product of an environment of impunity where the NTC authorities, difficult as their job is in this chaotic environment, where the NTC authorities have not done nearly enough to start building a political culture where if you do something wrong, regardless of who you are and what your loyalties are, you're going to be investigated. That's the first step. The second step is to make sure that every single person in Libya who is detained today has access to doctors, has access to medical care, and certainly has access to a lawyer. None of these basic standards are being met right now, and you potentially have thousands of people living in these circumstances in detention centers or jails, quite frankly, across the country.
Can you share with us some of the incidents that your teams witnessed or the nature of torture or death that has been encountered?
Sure. One example, the relatives of a former police officer and father of two from a town east of Tripoli told Amnesty International that the father, the former police officer, had been detained by a local armed militia in October of last year and that they hadn't been able to obtain any information about his fate for 3 weeks. And then they received a call where he was allowed to call his wife. And then a few days later, his family was informed by a hospital in Tripoli that his body had been brought in. And that body reveals deep bruising all over the body and limbs, open wounds, you know, all kinds of grotesque and clear signs of torture. And this is just one example of a number of situations where Amnesty International has confirmed deaths that have occurred with what are very obvious signs of torture from people who were detained or held or who had been disappeared.
The range of wounds, is it primarily brute force, blunt trauma, or cuttings or fractures? Or have you witnessed any sign of more sophisticated instruments in the exercise of torture?
You know, my impression, based on what my colleagues who were on the Libya mission are sharing with us, is that it's not the a sophisticated kind that where you might have a central government that is deploying, you know, tools and technology. But there are still, you know, significant signs of a range of torture practices, you know, torture wounds that have been inflicted all over the body, the use of whips, cables. I think you might have mentioned some of this at the beginning of our of this section of your show. You know, whips, cables, plastic hoses, electroshock weapons, a grotesque diversity of ways in which local militias and authorities have used violence in their interrogations and in their treatment of detainees.
We're speaking with Sanjeev Berry, the Advocacy Director for Middle East and North African Affairs of Amnesty International. And Sanjeev, witnessing also carries its hazards and risks. Can you tell us how the Amnesty team went about its work? Were there any jeopardies that were faced, and how was this coordinated? And how did you get access, and how forthcoming were the victims?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I know this is a very interesting question, and it would be a very interesting answer, but the details of how we go about, you know, both ensuring the safety of our colleagues as well as access on the ground sometimes involves confidential information, access to friendly networks, and an evaluation process so that we can make sure that the information we then provide to the broader global public is, in fact, as accurate as possible. But I can't really go into too much detail without, you know, violating some of the confidentialities that are involved with getting our researchers on the ground and giving them access to detention centers and getting them from point A to point B safely.
Understood and appreciated. The director of the action in Libya, Donatella Rovera, says we're not aware of any proper investigations into cases of torture, and neither the survivors or relatives of those who have died in detention have had any recourse to justice or redress for what they have suffered. What is the level of death in proportion to the torture?
The level of death?
Yes. How many deaths are you aware of, and how common is that in the course of these detentions?
That again, is another one of those pieces of information that is difficult to speak to definitively in an environment of impunity and in an environment of these localized authorities. Amnesty International has directly confirmed a number of deaths through the interviews that my colleagues have conducted and the information they have gathered, but it is extraordinarily difficult to speak definitively in numerical terms, because there are so many different detention centers and so many different militias on the ground.
The issue of the non-responsiveness of the transitional regime in Libya is being characterized as frustrating by a number of human rights activists and people of concern. Why do you think there is no real motion on ending these behaviors?
There are probably a lot of different reasons for that. This is what you could call a chaotic or a post-revolution environment in which the central authority has not, is still quite shaky and is still dealing with a lot of different dispersed authority figures in different parts of Libya and at different communities. You know, to its credit, in mid to late 2011, the NTC, transitional authorities, did issue a constitutional declaration enshrining some of the basic principles around international human rights and international humanitarian law. But today, on the ground, what you just said is accurate. There is a climate of impunity. There's no accountability. If you've lost a loved one, or a loved one has disappeared in Libya or in your local community, there's no place for you to go. And as some of the reporting has indicated, police are even afraid to accompany victims or family members of victims, because there are so many weapons floating around, and in some cases the police themselves are afraid if they aren't directly connected to the local militia authorities. And that is the big problem here. But even with this immensely difficult task, there are still some very basic things that the NTC can move towards doing that Amnesty International would like to see the Libyan authorities do, and they haven't yet taken these steps.
In diplomatic terms, I noticed that there is quite a bit of civilian reportage In regard to the misbehaviors of various governments, and particularly some more than others, so let me put the question to you this way. Would it be helpful if leaders of nations that instigated the overthrow of the Libyan Arab Jamahiriya made explicit statements condemning and making their support for this new regime contingent upon the end of these abuses? And I'm looking at you, France, United States, the United Kingdom, NATO, etc.
Strong statements from governments that are in communication with the Libyan authorities would definitely be very important to accelerating a path towards accountability and justice. So long as Libyan authorities are acting in this sort of almost lackadaisical manner with regards to these fundamental issues, so long as they've made the problem of torture and detention a very low priority problem for them to deal with, these sorts of practices could continue for years. The challenge right now is for there to be a strong international voice saying to the Libyan authorities, you have to do something about this. You have to shut these detention centers down. You have to centralize the remaining detention centers under central ministries of the new government, and you have to bring law and order into the process. You can't have this kind of chaos in which people have been snatched off of the streets based on skin color or tribal affiliation or alleged participation in Gaddafi loyalist troops and militias, these sorts of things. This practice has to be brought to an end.
What are the recommendations that are brought forward in the report, Libya, Deaths of Detainees Amid Widespread Torture? What are the most essential and immediate things that Amnesty is recommending be done?
Well, the first thing is that the Libyan authorities need to order the closure of all unofficial places of detention and set up mechanisms and systems to bring the remaining detention centers under the control of central authorities. You can't have a situation where the central government is not in charge of, you know, all of these different places where people are being held. Now, Amnesty International also wants to see effective oversight over detention procedures and practices. We want to see that the Libyan government is actually paying attention to what's happening at these centers and what's happening to the people at them. They're also, Amnesty International also wants to see prompt investigations of any allegations of torture and other ill treatment. People who have been alleged to be involved with repeat acts of torture or even isolated acts of torture need to be immediately removed from any functions dealing with detainees or detentions until these investigations are concluded. Right now, there are no investigations, and anybody who is potentially a repeat torturer continues doing what they were doing in impunity. So I'd say those are the two big things. Then, of course, all detainees need to have access to lawyers, and all detainees need to have access to regular medical examinations to make sure that any torture is documented and that detainees have some kind of due process to find out why they're being held and to have a chance to challenge that the allegations against them.
How may people obtain this report or review it and help the good work of your good offices?
Well, thank you for that opportunity. If you go to amnestyusa.org or amnesty.org, both of the websites where you can read some of the details with regards to what our researchers have found.
Well, thank you so much, and we really appreciate your being here on this urgent matter. We've been speaking with Sanjeev Berry, the Advocacy Director of Middle East and North African Region for Amnesty International USA, speaking with us live from Washington, D.C. Thank you, Sanjeev.
Thank you.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight, and we now continue on the theme of what is happening in Libya, as we are joined by Dan Kovalik, speaking with us live from Pittsburgh, an attorney with a deep interest in human rights, and recently the author of a piece called Seven Truths Inconvenient to U.S. Foreign Policy. And many of those are about the situation in Libya. Dan, welcome to 5 O'Clock Shadow. And would you like to continue with what you think are the salient points about the abuses and misperceptions of what horrible things are actually taking place in Libya under this new regime that was created by the United States and its Western allies?
Well, first of all, what I want to emphasize is Almost invariably, the run-up to the wars that the U.S. is involved in are preceded by lies to justify those wars. In this case, in Libya, Hillary Clinton had claimed, you might recall, last year, as a pretext for regime change, that Gaddafi's troops were engaged in mass rapes of civilians. In fact, she even said that Gaddafi was personally handing out Viagra to his troops to rape opponents of his regime. Now, you know, to most of us that seemed outlandish on its face, but nonetheless the press reported it as truth. Amnesty International, who I know you just interviewed, actually went on the ground in Libya to investigate those claims. And here's what they said. They said, not only have we not met any victims, we've not even met any persons who have met victims, unquote, of those alleged rapes. And so here we see that the entire pretext of the war was based on falsehoods. And in fact, as the war proceeded, it was a civil war with NATO backing one side of that war, the so-called rebels. And as it proceeded, you know, if you recall early on, the whole basis for the no-fly zone, which the UN approved, they never approved regime change, but in terms of the no-fly zone, they approved it because the U.S. and other NATO allies claimed civilians were in imminent harm by Gaddafi troops. In fact, as Gaddafi troops took over or regained territory, the truth is they did not engage in massive human rights abuses, which were feared. At the same time, the Libyan rebels, in some cases, did. In fact, the most notorious case is that of the town of Tawarga, which was one of 10,000 residents, mostly black Africans as opposed to Arabs. The rebels took over the town. They actually forced all the residents out of the town into a refugee camp and then burned the refugee camp. And so, and we know that, in fact, the rebels have targeted black Africans in that country, claiming that they were mercenaries for Gaddafi. That turned out not to be true as well. And so the concern I have is that the entire war was based on lies, and now we have a situation of great instability in that country, and frankly, a regime with kind of spotty popular support.
One of the issues here also is the destruction of a stable social system. I mean, certainly with its own existence of human rights abuses, but at the same time, almost like other nations, the United States has invaded a pragmatic form of stability that took one of the more advanced social systems in regard to women's access to positions of authority and unleashed the old tribal demons that are manifesting now in racism and human rights abuse. What is it about U.S. foreign policy and its allies' foreign policy that finds this a worthwhile trade-off?
Well, that's an interesting point. In fact, I don't think they even see it as a trade-off. I, in fact, think, to be perfectly honest, that the U.S. views countries with social systems that protect workers and that protect the people as bad examples. You know, for years, critics have talked about the danger of a good example, that the U.S. doesn't want positive examples of development in the third world because people in the third world would get a bad idea that they could become independent of U.S. Economic hegemony and develop their own system. In the case of Libya, and I don't want to sound like an apologist for Gaddafi, which I'm not, but the truth is, for all his faults, and he did have many, when he took over in the late 60s, Libya had the worst human indicators in Africa in terms of education, health care, infant mortality, life expectancy, and he brought it, frankly, to the very best in Africa. And even the UN recognized this, that under his regime, again, for all its faults in terms of lack of democracy, they had very advanced education, very high literacy, very good health care. People who got married and bought a home were given $15,000 to be able to do that. Gas was prices were regulated at 60 cents a gallon. The fact is people in Libya lived pretty well under Gaddafi, much better than most people in Africa. Gaddafi supported progressive social agendas in Africa, supported liberation movements, was about to create a bank for Africa so they wouldn't be dependent on the IMF, for example. These were things the U.S. did not like. In fact, it was quite ironic. I was listening to NPR shortly after Gaddafi had fallen and was killed, and they talked about the biggest hurdles that I guess mainstream economists saw to kind of bringing Libya forward in the way they viewed as forward was the fact that they were the most protected workers in the world. I mean, this is a quote from NPR. The most protected workers in the world with an advanced welfare state, and that they were going to now have to wean the people off of these social supports. You know, I mean, that's the, you know, that was the hideousness of Muammar Gaddafi from their point of view. I mean, that is what is incredibly troubling. They lied us into a war and destroyed a country with a very advanced social system.
We're speaking with Dan Kovalik live from Pittsburgh, and I commend people's attention to the current number of the journal Counterpunch, where you have an article called Seven Truths Inconvenient to U.S. Foreign Policy. And Dan, I understand that you have a book coming out about which I hope to speak with you in future encounters called Hopeless, Barack Obama and the Politics of Illusion. With that, I would ask you to tell us how people can follow your work.
Well, I appreciate it very much. I do write regularly on Counterpunch, also on Huffington Post, and you can follow me at those sites, and I hope you do.
Well, we have only scratched the surface. I thank you for your insight and clarity on a very painful and troubling issue that hopefully can become less so the more we know, and I thank you for helping that process.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow. Robert Knight here. One more element about current events in Libya today. There was a major blistering statement delivered to the United Nations Security Council, yes, the one that fig-leafed the invasion and overthrow of Libya through resolutions 1970 and 1973, in which this official of the United Nations Human Rights Commission addressed the human rights abuse, torture, the detention in Libya, and explicitly enumerated the extent to which it is racial bigotry that has victimized so many Afro-Libyans. And we now hear her direct words to the United Nations Security Council about exactly this matter, the detention, the torture, and the racism in the new regime in Libya.
In November last year, His Excellency Interim Prime Minister Abdelrahim Al-Kaib told the media that his government would, I quote, build a nation that respects human rights and does not accept the abuse of human rights. He noted that they need time to put this into practice. And as Mr. Martin said, in December, the National Council for Public Liberties and Human Rights was established. In addition, the authorities have begun undertaking the arduous task of legal reform and the adoption of new legislation. Of relevance in this regard is the adoption of a law on transitional justice, as yet to be made public, on which OHCHR has provided extensive comments through the our staff in UNSMO. I commend the Libyan authorities for their sense of urgency in addressing pressing issues by means of strengthening the legal framework. Before new laws are enacted, care needs to be exercised to ensure their compliance with international human rights standards and to undertake wide consultations on their provisions with all relevant actors and stakeholders. At the same time, the human rights situation remains of concern and requires increased vigilance by and sustained assistance from the international community. Undoubtedly, immense challenges lie ahead. The interim government still does not exercise effective control over the revolutionary brigades, and this has human rights repercussions in a number of areas. Light and heavy weaponry in the hands of these brigades pose a threat to public security and the protection of the human rights of the population. A related area that I am extremely concerned about is the conditions of detention and treatment of detainees held by various revolutionary brigades. The ICRC visited over 8,500 detainees in approximately 60 places of detention between March and December 2011. The majority of detainees are accused of being Gaddafi loyalists and include a large number of sub-Saharan African nationals. The lack of oversight by the central authorities creates an environment conducive to torture and ill treatment. My staff have received alarming reports that this is happening in places of detention that they have visited. It is therefore urgent that all detention centers are brought under the control of the Ministry of Justice and the General Prosecutor's Office. Moreover, a structure and process for judicial screening of detainees should be put in place immediately so that those detainees held without any legal basis can be released while others receive a fair trial. The interim government has made some effort to address the existing legal vacuum. For example, on 29 November, the Minister of the Interior issued a decision stipulating which authorities have jurisdiction to arrest, detain, and investigate. In addition, in December, the Minister of Justice reported that the judicial police had assumed control over 6 detention facilities. However, detainees continue to be held in unacceptable circumstances outside any legal framework or the protection of the state. The situation of persons subjected to internal forced and involuntary displacement also remains an area of concern. The United Nations estimates that as of January 2012, 60% of Libyans have been able to return to their homes in the towns of Bani Walid and Sirte after the end of the fighting. However, several other groups are unable to return home for fear of reprisals. For example, some 35,000 residents of Tawaga, who are accused by residents of the nearby town of Misrata of involvement in serious crimes, are housed in camps or other accommodation across the country, and many of the men are held by revolutionary brigades in detention, where many have reported being subject to torture. Let us not forget the situation of women in Libya. Despite some gains for women's rights in previous years, inequality and discrimination in many areas of women's life persist in law and practice. Diverse views exist within Libyan society as to the status of women and their role in society. In light of the NTC's recent decision not to stipulate a minimum percentage for women's representation in the National Congress, I would like to emphasize that facilitating stronger representation of women in public life will be an essential step towards ensuring that the revolution brings meaningful achievements for women and girls across the country. Addressing past abuses. In addition to addressing ongoing human rights concerns, Libyans are faced with the enormous challenge of addressing past abuses. These include violations committed during the former regime, as well as violations of international human rights and international humanitarian law committed during the conflict, as documented in the first report of the International Commission of Inquiry on Libya, mandated by the Human Rights Council. We must not forget that the Libyan people rose up to remove a tyrannical ruler whose regime committed atrocious human rights violations against its own people. Torture, unlawful killings, and enforced disappearance were widely practiced. Families of the disappeared, including over 1,200 prisoners allegedly killed in the 1996 Abu Salim prison massacre, continue to wait for truth and for justice to be done. Acts amounting to the mere exercise of freedom of expression and association frequently resulted in the death penalty, including after unfair trials before the People's Court and later the State Security Court. I commend the Libyan authorities' stated commitment to transitional justice processes and mechanisms, as these would enable Libya to deal with these abuses, and we stand ready to provide assistance. These processes should lead to the legislative and institutional reforms, including within the security sector, required to ensure justice, accountability, and reparations for victims, and guarantees for non-repetition in compliance with international human rights standards. Moreover, international law requires the prosecution of individuals who may be criminally responsible for international crimes. Furthermore, there remain outstanding questions regarding possible civilian deaths resulting from NATO operations. The Commission of Inquiry is currently investigating these allegations, and any findings it reaches will be important in shedding light on the extent to which NATO forces took all feasible measures to protect civilians in all their military operations. Information so far indicates that NATO made efforts to keep civilian casualties at a minimum, but where civilians have been killed and injured, the alliance should disclose information about all such events and about remedial actions undertaken. Current investigations by the Commission are also aimed to deepen initial findings into the question of sexual violence, in particular to ascertain the extent and whether cases were linked to incitement by the command of either side. I call upon all sides, including NATO, to cooperate fully with the Commission of Inquiry in the current final phase of their investigations into these and other issues. In this phase of the Commission's investigations, members of the Secretariat and the Commissioners are currently in Libya conducting the last of three missions. On 9th March 2012, the Commissioners will discuss the findings of their final report with the members of the Human Rights Council. Following the publication of the second report, the focus should be on implementation of all recommendations issued by the Commission. With the support of my office, the Human Rights Section within UNSMIL, as mandated by this Council, will play an important role in this regard. In addition to providing Secretariat support to the Commission, in October, I sent two senior OHCHR staff members to Tripoli, Benghazi, and Misrata on a one-week mission to assess needs and assist in setting the priorities of the human rights component within UNSMIL. In their discussions with government representatives and emerging civil society actors, particular attention was given to the issues of transitional justice, detention, women's rights, minorities and migrants, racism and xenophobia. With the establishment of the Human Rights Section within UNSMIL, headed by my representative, I deployed OHCHR staff members on a temporary basis to bolster capacity, and I have initiated a consultancy to strengthen civil society capacity in monitoring and advocating for human rights protection. Mr. President, allow me to conclude by stressing the following points. Firstly, urgent steps need to be taken to put an end to current abuses, particularly those occurring in detention. Secondly, I welcome the priority attention given by the authorities to transitional justice processes and mechanisms, and I encourage them to expeditiously make their commitment to transitional justice a reality. The processes and mechanisms must address both abuses committed by the former regime as well as those committed during the conflict by all actors and must be established after an informed national consultation. Thirdly, in the major undertakings of the coming weeks and months, the authorities should use civil society activists and organizations, including women and youth groups, as a key resource in addressing a range of social and political challenges. Thorough consultations with civil society groups will be critical in developing lasting solutions to the challenges of today. And finally, I would like to reiterate my office's commitment to continue to support the Libyan people to realize their rights. Working together, UNSMIL Human Rights Section and OHCHR headquarters are ready to respond to requests for technical assistance, for example, in the area of legal and institutional reform, to help in consultation processes, to build capacities, including those of key state institutions, such as the police, the judiciary, and penitentiary institutions, and to monitor and report on human rights developments. Ultimately, the task is for the Libyan people to forge their own future built on a firm basis of respect for rule of law and for international human standards.
And that, Navi Pillay, the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, speaking overnight to the United Nations Security Council. And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow, with appreciation to our guests today, Sanjeev Berry of Amnesty International, speaking with us from Washington, D.C., and human rights and labor attorney Daniel Kovalik, speaking with us live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Thanks also to our engineer, Michael G. Haskins, and for listeners who support public radio. We welcome your comments, leaks, tips, suggestions, and questions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.